Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents An Independent Empire, Diplomacy and War in the Making of the United States by Michael S. Cochin and Michael Taylor. Narrated by Walter Dixon. Introduction. An Independent Empire. The rebellious war now levied is become more general, and is manifestly carried on for the purpose of establishing an independent empire. King George III's Address to Parliament, October 27, 1775. On a frozen morning in February 1807, in a Colorado wilderness, bound in the adamantine chains of winter, Zebulon Pike was informed of the report of a gun. Pike was 28 years old, a captain in the United States Army, and a man devoted to the arts and science of warfare. The son of a military father, he claimed to have read every book which could be procured in the French and English language on my profession. Pike was also a celebrated pioneer of the new American West, who had led a damned set of rascals to the headwaters of the Mississippi River in 1805. On this cold February morning in 1807, when a gunshot broke the hibernal silence, Pike was the commanding officer of another daring frontier expedition. But Captain Pike was in the wrong place. 8 months previously, he had received his orders from General James Wilkinson, the senior officer of the Army. Pike's destination was the west of Louisiana, the vast continental territory that the United States had just acquired from Napoleonic France. Ostensibly, the purpose of the mission was scientific. "In the course of your tour," wrote Wilkinson, "you are to remark particularly upon the geographical structure, the natural history, and population of the country through which you may pass." The American explorers were instructed to take particular care to collect and preserve specimens of everything curious on the mineral or botanical worlds which can be preserved and are portable. Wilkinson also relayed an order from the highest heights of the federal government. "It is an object of much interest with the executive," he told Pike, "to ascertain the direction, extent, and navigation of the Arkansas and Red Rivers." Having overseen the Louisiana Purchase in 1803, President Thomas Jefferson now wanted to know what he had bought. However, Wilkinson's orders also came with a warning. "The head branches of the Arkansas and Red Rivers," he advised, "were approximate to the settlements of New Mexico, the Spanish colony that stretched from Juarez in the south to present-day Colorado in the north." Pike was cautioned to move with great circumspection, to keep clear of any hunting or reconnoitering parties from that province, and to prevent alarm or offense. The Spanish government in New Mexico was not to be disturbed, for "the affairs of Spain and the United States appear to be on the point of amicable adjustment." Wilkinson emphasized how President Jefferson wished to cultivate the friendship and harmonious intercourse of all the nations of the earth, and particularly our near neighbors, the Spaniards. In other words, Pike was told not to cross the Spanish border, and, if that was impossible, not to get caught. The Pike expedition left Fort Bellefontaine on the south bank of the Missouri River in July 1806. Besides 51 Osage Indians who had recently been ransomed by the United States, Pike took with him 2 lieutenants, 1 surgeon, 1 sergeant, 2 corporals, 16 privates, and 1 interpreter. At first, the expedition enjoyed no little success. Pike's men returned the Osages to their homeland and then forced the Pawnees of southern Nebraska to raise the American flag in place of the Spanish. Yet, by late October, the expedition had split in two. 5 men and 2 Osage scouts followed Lieutenant James Wilkinson, the son of the general, back down the Arkansas River, while 13 enlisted men, the surgeon, and the interpreter plowed on with Pike. From here, wrong turn followed wrong turn. Soon caught between the wilds of winter and the insolence, cupidity, and barbarity of the savages, Pike and his men resolved to build a stockade in a small prairie on the West Fork of the Red River. As the palisades rose from the ground, Pike spent his days reading, hunting deer, and refreshing his memory as to the French grammar. Heeding some of his instructions from Wilkinson, Pike also investigated the wild terrain around his base, marveling at the numerous springs which issued from the foot of the hill opposite to our camp, which were so strongly impregnated with mineral qualities as to keep clear of ice. This serene exploration was not to last. In mid-February, during one of his many sorties, Pike and a companion were spied from the summit of a hill by a Spanish dragoon and a civilized Indian. Mindful not to give alarm or offense to America's neighbors, Pike strove to lose the scouts to avoid further exposure. But the Spaniard and the Indian would not be deterred. Giving chase through the ice and snow of the cold western winter, they pursued Pike, at full charge, flourishing their lances. And when at last the four met in a ravine, pleasantries were exchanged only with great precaution. The tension eased. Pike invited the Spaniard and the Indian back to the American stockade, and his unwelcome guests eventually left without incident. But Pike was unnerved. He now feared another attention from the Spaniards or their emissaries. And so, later that month, when his lookout heard gunfire and reported the approach of strangers, Pike was not surprised. The strangers were Frenchmen in the service of the Spanish crown, and they claimed to come with an offer of help. The Utah Indians, they told Pike, were planning to attack the Americans, but the benevolent governor of New Mexico, Joaquin del Real Alencaster, would not stand for such atrocity. 50 dragoons were being sent to the aid of Pike and his men. The promised dragoons arrived almost immediately, and with them, ominously, were 50 mounted militia of the province, armed in the same manner, viz. Lances, escopetas, and pistols. Unable to protest, Pike welcomed the Spanish officers inside, and they breakfasted on some deer, meal, goose, and some biscuit. The Americans hoped that if they parlayed, and if the Spanish simply returned to New Mexico, a diplomatic crisis could be avoided. But this hope proved false. "Sir," the Spanish told Pike, "the governor of New Mexico, being informed you had missed your route, ordered me to offer you, in his name, mules, horses, money, or whatever you may stand in need of to conduct yourself to the head of the Red River." "What?" interrupted the American. "Is this not the Red River?" "No, sir," came the reply. It was the Rio del Norte. Pike, the great explorer, was mortified. He had confused the rivers and inadvertently erected his palisades on Spanish soil. "I ordered my flag to be taken down and rolled up," he noted, feeling how sensibly I had committed myself in entering their territory. Pike and his men were promptly arrested and marched southward through Santa Fe and Albuquerque, coming at last to Los Cabos in Chihuahua. It was not until July, 5 months after his apprehension, that Pike was returned to the United States, appropriately on the Red River in Louisiana. Pike's abortive foray into the West might be considered a curious place to start any history of the United States. Certainly, the Pike expedition is much less known than the widely lauded Lewis and Clark expedition, and for good reason. Meriwether Lewis and William Clark charted a course from St. Louis to the Pacific Ocean and back again, laying the path for the westward expansion of the United States, and so their names belong to the American pantheon. Zebulon Pike got lost, captured, and humiliated. His reputation for posterity was secured only at the Battle of York, 1813, where he was fatally wounded during the American victory over the British. Yet of these two explorations of the American West, the Pike expedition better reflects the early imperial history of the United States. In trying to conduct official business in alien, unforgiving environments, Pike was undermanned and under-resourced, just as the early federal government struggled to impose order on the enormous American continent. On his travels, Pike was obliged to deal with Native American tribes, both friendly and hostile, just as the federal government was forced to treat and fight with the Iroquois, the Western Confederacy, the Creeks, and the Seminoles to the east of the Mississippi River. Pike also struggled to avoid conflict with a rival empire, just as the United States sought to avoid open war with the British, French, and Spanish. The failure of the Pike expedition remains a salutary reminder of the uncertain prospects of the early republic itself. Indeed, the transformation of 13 British colonies into the United States of America, and then into one of the great powers of the world, is the most remarkable story in modern political history. When the seeds of the American Revolution were first sown in the 1760s, the 13 colonies were but a string of coastal settlements along the eastern seaboard, mere pawns in the imperial games of the old world. That those colonies would even attempt to overthrow the might of the British Empire was, for many observers on both sides of the Atlantic, simply absurd. When reconciliation with Great Britain became impossible, and when independence was declared in 1776, the new American nation was nothing more than an ambitious experiment in republican self-government. There was no guarantee of its success, and several good reasons to expect its failure. "We have not men fit for the times," wrote John Adams. "We are deficient in genius, in education, in travel, in fortune, in everything. I feel unutterable anxiety." Nevertheless, despite Adams's pessimism, these United States of America, a term first coined by Jefferson in June 1776, quickly became what George III feared, an independent empire. By 1826, after only 5 decades of independence, the American Union had become the imperial master of much of North America and the self-proclaimed guardian of the Western Hemisphere. Diplomacy and war were essential to the creation and the survival of the United States. It was only with foreign assistance that the Revolutionary War was won. Even when independence was secured in 1783 by the Treaty of Paris, the new republic was surrounded by European colonies and hostile forces. To the north, smarting from their recent defeat, were the British in Canada. To the south, governing the Gulf of Mexico, was Spanish Florida. To the west were Native American tribes and Spanish Louisiana, which controlled the vital conduit of the Mississippi and the port of New Orleans. Independence did not bring security. The initial borders of the United States were painfully vulnerable to European and indigenous forces. "American troops," wrote James Madison, "were an object of contempt to the inimical tribes with which we are surrounded. It is also to be apprehended that we suffer much from the agency of British and Spanish partisans." The presence of these hostile powers meant that the United States, the American Empire, could not and did not expand inexorably into a continental vacuum. Territorial growth was not the manifest destiny of the nation. In fact, it required careful planning, negotiation with rival empires, and the steady, guided use of military force. It was not a coincidence that each of the 4 presidents elected between 1800 and 1824 had also been Secretary of State. More prosaically, but no less importantly, the United States needed to make international trade deals. Although possessed of an abundance of natural resources, the American economy, where it went beyond the bountiful but cash-poor agriculture of Western settlements, was commercial and mercantile. The clear majority of Americans lived within 50 miles of the eastern coast, and all the leading cities, Boston, New York, Philadelphia, Charleston, and Savannah, were ports whose merchants depended upon international custom. Yet by declaring independence from Great Britain, American merchants were denied favorable terms of trade with the British and the remaining colonies. This was potentially disastrous, because from the first tobacco planted in Virginia to the first ships launched in Massachusetts, the American economy had been designed to supply the British Empire. American diplomats urgently needed to negotiate better access to British markets, to make deals with other European nations, and even to arrange the protection of American shipping from the pirates of the West Indies and North Africa. Most significant of all, by trying to build a federal government to support and sustain its independence, the United States was obliged to answer 3 challenges that faced all aspiring masters of the North American continent. First, how to best acquire new lands while defending settlers from hostile Native Americans and other foreign powers. Second, how could political and military control be exerted over distant and extensive territories? Third, what was the most appropriate and affordable system of government that could unite such a diverse nation? These questions had confounded the British, and the success and survival of the United States were therefore contingent upon the right choices being made by politicians at home, by diplomats at negotiating tables, and by military men in the field. Missteps and humiliations, like Zebulon Pike's calamitous expedition, were the frequent result of this ad hoc process. However, in the half-century following 1776, American politicians, diplomats, and generals found workable answers to their challenges. By doing so, American leaders also confirmed the imperial character of the nation. The United States might have been Republican, and in the words of Jefferson, an empire of liberty, but by conquering territory, by subjugating Native Americans and European settlers, and by developing and then using military force, the United States became the paramount empire in North America, an independent empire. Chapter 1. The British and the Problems of American Empire. The rulers of Great Britain have, for more than a century past, amused the people with the imagination that they possessed a great empire on the west side of the Atlantic. This empire, however, has hitherto existed in imagination only. It has been not an empire, but the project of an empire. Not a gold mine, but the project of a gold mine. It is surely now time that our rulers should either realize this golden dream, in which they have been indulging themselves, perhaps, as well as the people, or that they should awake from it themselves and endeavor to awaken the people. Adam Smith, The Wealth of Nations, 1776. If the 15th century belonged to the Portuguese, and the 16th to the Spanish, and if the 17th century was defined by la gloire of the Sun King, King Louis XIV, it was in the long 18th century that Great Britain emerged as a global force. This rise to power began with the Glorious Revolution of 1688, when the Catholic King James II was deposed and replaced by William of Orange, the Protestant Dutch stadtholder. According to its most revered historian, this was, of all revolutions, the least violent and the most beneficent, being both the signal of deliverance of England from popery and absolutism, and the vindication of ancient rights. Crowned at Westminster Abbey as William III, the new king was a pensive, severe, and solemn man who had never been young. He soon dragged his British subjects into his ongoing continental war with France, the War of the League of Augsburg. With memorable military victories at the Boyne in Ireland and La Hogue off the Normandy coast, and with the concurrent development of stable parliamentary government in London, the British ascent had begun. 9 years of war against France were ended by the Treaty of Ryswick, 1697, but this brought only momentary peace. In 1700, Europe was again thrown into turmoil when the King of Spain, the infirm and bewitched Carlos II, died without issue. Addled by generations of inbreeding, the Habsburg line of Philip II had failed, and by 1702 the nations of Europe were fighting over who would ascend the Spanish throne. In this, the War of the Spanish Succession, the British were established as a major military power. The Duke of Marlborough, the direct ancestor of Winston Churchill, recorded stunning triumphs over French forces at Ramilly, Oudenarde, Malplaquet, and notably Blenheim, after which he wrote to his wife Sarah that God had blessed Her Majesty's army with as great a victory as has ever been known. Marlborough's royal reward was the construction of the magnificent Blenheim Palace in Oxfordshire, and his success produced the terms of the Peace of Utrecht, 1713, that made Britain dominant in the Atlantic world. The British were given the asiento, the effective monopoly of the lucrative slave trade from Africa to Spanish America, the control of Gibraltar and Menorca in the Mediterranean and possession of the New World colonies of Newfoundland, Nova Scotia, and St. Kitts. With the death in 1714 of Queen Anne, the last Stuart monarch, the British throne passed to a middle-aged German prince of the House of Hanover. George I was far from the model king. He was deeply stupid, indolent, and irascible. He could speak not a word of English, and his divorce and imprisonment of his wife had earned him a justified reputation for vengeful cruelty. He was, however, Protestant, and that mattered most. George I was also the first British monarch to have a prime minister, with Robert Walpole establishing power in the wake of the financial crisis caused by the South Sea bubble. In the reign of his son, George II, there came the War of the Austrian Succession, 1740-48, which saw the king himself lead troops into battle at Dettingen in Germany. Despite British defeat at the Battle of Fontenoy in present-day Belgium in 1745, the Treaty of Aix-la-Chapelle, 1748, allowed the British to renew the Asiento and to regain the Indian city of Madras. George Friedrich Handel, who had written Zadok the Priest for George II's coronation, celebrated the peace by composing Music for the Royal Fireworks. In domestic politics, the reigns of the first two Georges were not without drama. In both 1715 and 1745, the Hanoverian monarchy was challenged by the rebellion of Jacobites, who remained loyal to the deposed Catholic line of the House of Stuart. The latter of these risings was led by the young pretender, Bonnie Prince Charlie. But a decisive victory for governmental forces at Culloden in the Scottish Highlands meant that Britain's constitutional monarchy survived and grew stable. The British ascendancy was confirmed by the Seven Years' War, 1756-63, begun under the reign of George II, and concluded by the Treaty of Paris, of the accession of his grandson, George III. Known in North America as the French and Indian War, this was a global conflict, the First World War. Its theaters ranged from Quebec to West Africa, from the cockpit of Europe in the Netherlands to the subcontinent of India, and the British left these battlefields as the world's leading political, commercial, and colonial power. National heroes were made of James Wolfe, who died on the plains of Abraham outside Quebec, and Robert Clive, the commander-in-chief of British India. By the terms of the peace, Great Britain won recognition of its Indian enclaves and gained control of French Canada, a host of Caribbean islands, and the two Floridas, East Florida and West Florida, on the Gulf of Mexico. Even more significantly, the French were humiliated. Yet such was Britain's position of strength that many regarded the Treaty of Paris as a diplomatic failure. One truculent observer even wrote that its terms had drawn the contempt of mankind on our wretched negotiators. This, then, was the British Empire of the 1700s, unmatched in extent and wealth, and a global power without peer. The growth of the British Empire, however, had come at a cost. To finance the Seven Years' War, the government had borrowed extensively from domestic and Dutch bankers, causing the national debt nearly to double, from £72 million sterling in 1755 to almost £130 million in 1764. Moreover, with the addition of French Canada to the American colonies, the ongoing expense of defending this transatlantic empire had increased enormously. The government calculated that it would cost more than £220,000 per year to station 10,000 additional troops in North America, and this deployment was rendered all the more urgent by the outbreak of Pontiac's Rebellion in 1763. Here, the decision of the British General Geoffrey Amherst to stop traditional payments and presents to Indian allies had provoked a confederacy of Native Americans into attacks on British forts and towns throughout the Great Lakes region. All but three forts were destroyed, and more than 2,000 settlers were slain. Amherst elected to respond in kind. "I am determined to take every measure in my power," he declared, "not only for securing and keeping entire possession of the country, but for punishing those barbarians who have thus perfidiously massacred His Majesty's subjects." The British general even tried to pioneer the egregious art of biological warfare, asking one of his colonels, "Could it not be contrived to send the smallpox among the disaffected tribes of Indians? With Pontiac threatening the security of the American colonies, it was incumbent upon George Greenville, who had replaced the unpopular Earl of Bute as Prime Minister, to find new means of financing the defense of Britain's Western Empire. Taxation and trade. Before 1765, the American colonies had been tightly bound into the British imperial economy, and so to the British exchequer. British taxation of the Americans was indirect, which meant that taxes were levied not on income, assets, or domestic produce, but on exports and imports. In accordance with Britain's navigation laws, American trade was routed through London, from which a watchful eye made sure these taxes were paid. Besides this, American industrial development was discouraged by a ban on competition with British manufacturers. The boon of the Industrial Revolution, fueled by the inventions of Thomas Newcomen, Richard Arkwright, and James Hargreaves, would be protected at all costs. American exportation to Britain of certain goods, grain, and meat was meanwhile outlawed completely. Not yet the free trade nation of David Ricardo and Richard Cobden, Great Britain in the 1760s was protectionist and jealous, even of its own colonies. All this chafed the Americans, but British economic policy was tolerated because it was imperfectly enforced and easily circumvented. Smuggling, for instance, was rife along the eastern seaboard, and shipping illicit rum and molasses from the West Indies was a popular and profitable display of defiance. When the British Parliament passed the Stamp Act in 1765 to raise money for the defense of the American colonies, it represented something different. It was the first attempt to impose direct taxation upon the colonists. Replicating a measure that had raised revenue effortlessly in Great Britain, the Stamp Act stipulated, first, that a wide range of documents had to be printed on paper imported from London, and, second, that the documents had to carry a revenue stamp that could be purchased only from colonial officials. Thomas Whately, the junior minister who had drawn up the Stamp Act, deemed this mode of taxation to be the easiest, the most equal, and the most certain that can be chosen. The ministers cleared the proposal with the agents of the colonies in London, who raised no objection. When it reached the colonies, however, Americans protested that this parliamentary direct taxation scheme was unconstitutional because the colonists were not represented, notwithstanding the British counterargument of virtual representation, in Parliament. The scenario prompted many well-read Americans to recall the personal rule of Charles I and the ship money controversy, when coastal areas of England were taxed by the king without legislative consent. The comparison might have been apt, but London still expected the colonists to pay up. After all, the tax had been authorized by Parliament, whose authority had been supreme since the Glorious Revolution. Many at Westminster also blamed the Americans for starting the 7 Years' War in the first place, so they believed the colonists should pay for what they had brought upon themselves. Charles Townshend, the MP for Harwich, derided any kind of opposition to the tax. "Will these Americans," he asked, "children, planted by our care, nourished up by our indulgence until they are grown to a degree of strength and opulence, and protected by our arms, will they grudge to contribute their mite to relieve us from the heavy weight of the burden which we lie under?" The Americans were to disappoint Townshend, for the breaking news of the tax caused civil unrest throughout the colonies. Archibald Hinchelwood, a Nova Scotia lawyer, wrote to the distiller Joshua Mauger of a violent spirit of opposition raised on the continent against the execution of the Stamp Act. Effigies of Andrew Oliver, the colonial official responsible for collecting the tax in Britain, were hung by the Sons of Liberty from the city's Liberty Tree. Attached to Oliver's effigy was a sign stating, "He that takes this down is an enemy to his country." The uproar was contagious. The Stamp Act also provoked the rancor of a more sophisticated constituency. By taxing printed materials such as newspapers and legal documents, it directly affected the journalists and lawyers who were best placed to articulate colonial discontent. One such lawyer was John Adams, a bustling attorney in the provincial town of Braintree, Massachusetts. Recently married to his third cousin Abigail, and already dabbling in
Sample complete. Ready to continue?